The date is the 19th of August 2015. My name is Clara Manassian Cook. I'm here with Norman Biggs, interviewing him as part of the 120th anniversary of LSE, the Oral History Project. So, Norman, can I ask you, because the recorder on the desk of that foil, can I ask you, when did you first come to LSE?
I came in 1988 as Professor of Mathematics.
And did you enter as an actual professor or as a...
Yes, I was appointed in the late spring, early summer of 1988, and I started here officially on the 1st of October, although I had been visiting beforehand regularly for a couple of months.
What were your first impressions of campus when you first arrived at LSE?
The campus was quite unlike the universities I'd worked in before, which were the University of Southampton and Royal Holloway University of London. Being in the centre of London, the offices were mixed up, as it were, with administrative staff. Departments were not at that time nested, in other words, in amongst the very few mathematicians. There was an office which was occupied by a geographer. The lecture theatres were rather small, cramped, and unsuitable at that time for teaching certainly larger classes.
And what were the students like that you first taught when you first arrived in the LSE?
There were relatively few students doing mathematics as a specific subject, because at that time the main degree of the LSE was the BSc Econ degree, and there was quite a long history of attempting to accommodate mathematics within that, and that had led at one point to a degree in mathematics, but it was relatively poorly recruited, very few students. I think the first specific course I taught partly was a course called Set Theory and Analysis, which would now be called Our Introduction to Abstract Mathematics. Now, 2015, that course has about 250 students every year. At that time, it had about 15.
And what did you think of the students, the 15 students that you were teaching?
They were heterogeneous, because some of them were doing the mathematics degree, some of them were doing an economics degree, there were few general course students, and I think there were even some maths and philosophy students. So it was hard to form a sort of serious impression of what the group as a whole was like.
What was, at that time, what were the colleagues like in the department that you worked with?
Well, the department, like the students, was heterogeneous in that there were... the mathematics group was technically a sub-department of a department called Statistical and Mathematical Sciences, and Statistical and Mathematical Sciences had five sub-departments. It had Mathematics, Statistics, Operational Research, Information Systems, and Population Studies. Now, of those, only the Mathematics and Statistics departments focused on mathematics and statistics. The other three were in various degrees removed from mathematics, and the whole thing had been sort of thrown together. I think the idea of departments at the LSE had grown up relatively late, and that was one of the main things that I noticed when I came here. I came from institutions where the department was the centre of one's activity, and one saw relatively little of the higher levels, the faculty or the institution as a whole, whereas at the LSE, it's still rather felt that the LSE was the sort of overriding institution, and mathematics and even the Department of Statistical and Mathematical Sciences were sort of rather loose collections of people and interests. And in particular, to answer your question about mathematics, there were 6.5 of us in the mathematics group sub-department at that time, and their interests were very widespread. The department was actually in the process of considerable change at that time, because with retirements and people leaving, there was an opportunity to rebuild, and that was what had been envisaged when I was appointed. And in fact, there were 2 vacancies either available or forthcoming, which I was going to fill in the next year or so. And that enabled us to begin building up a more coherent group of people who had academic interests related to each other.
Did the difference about what you're talking about from other departments in other universities centred on mathematics and the very mixed specialisms here at LSE, did that pose any like significant challenges?
Well, it posed, at that time, we were just beginning this regime, which has culminated in these REF and so forth in recent years. The first of those, first forerunner of the REFs, I think, was in 1989, soon after I came here. And, of course, as mathematicians, a small group of disparate people, we didn't expect to do very well. And fortunately, at that time, the institution, the LSE, was not particularly bothered about that, both globally and particularly in the course of mathematics, because it knew rebuilding was going on. But it was clear very quickly that there would have to be some considerable changes, both on the research and teaching side, if we were ever to become what I would now regard as a viable department of mathematics.
How has your post here at LSE changed over the years?
Well, when I came, I was the only professor of mathematics, and so I was technically called the sub-convener of the mathematics sub-department. That meant I operated with a fair degree of freedom within this very small group, but as I've pointed out, the department did have a formal status, and so things like promotions and so forth had to go through the Department of Statistical and Mathematical Sciences, and an awful lot of things were still done at the institutional level. For example, the recruitment of students and the admission of students, which in my previous universities had always been very much the a function of the department and the mathematicians. Here I discovered that although there was a mathematics and economics special subject in the BSc Econ degree, the mathematicians had no say whatever in either admitting or tutoring those students. That was all farmed out around the LSE in what seemed to me rather strange ways. So there was no feeling at that time that there was any sort of group of students taking mathematics. The numbers taking the special mathematics degree were actually relatively small, I think probably only 10 or so a year at that time, though there was obviously potential for very many more. And so the changes came when people started to question the whole structure. And this happened after John Ashworth was appointed, when he set up various working groups to look at, I think, four aspects of the LSE's work. I was lucky enough to get on to the one that was to look at the teaching structure, and I was very relieved to find that across the institution most people were fed up with the old BSc Econ because it was so nebulous, in it didn't have much focus, and that group, that teaching working group, recommended that the BSc Econ should be abolished and should be replaced by specialist degrees, which were basically owned by departments. And so that was much more familiar to me as the kind of organisation that had worked in the universities I'd been before. And of course it turned out that that was the opportunity for mathematics to become, as it were, the owner of a degree and a group of students in reasonable numbers, and to justify our existence, basically.
When that change came about, would you say that was one of the main highlights of your time here at LSE, when that change came about?
There have been several highlights, but that, without that change, the mathematics department could not have developed as it did. There was still no mathematics department when that happened, and when the principal was accepted, it then became important that there should be a mathematics and economics degree owned by the maths department, although there wasn't a maths department at the time. But very quickly, I think it was 1995, after we'd had another one of these pre-REF type efforts, it became clear that there had to be more focus if the institution was going to prosper. And so there was sympathy towards setting up a mathematics department. And in 1995, it was actually the mathematicians and myself in particular that proposed this. I think we proposed it about 1993-94, that the various groups in the statistical and mathematical sciences department should be restructured. So mathematics became a department, statistics became a department, and the other bits and pieces went off to form parts of management, I think, and in one part the population studies people went off to social administration. So that the sort of idea that we had this sort of motley collection of people who were basically statistical and mathematical was abandoned, and we were allowed to pursue a more coherent policy both for mathematics and for statistics.
At that point in time, what were the subjects that you were going to teach?
Well, we were going to teach as much mathematics of the sort that is normally taught in mathematics departments as we could within the confines of a joint degree, because the degree was mathematics and economics. We also had some other degrees which ought to be mentioned. We had set up a business mathematics and statistics degree, which gave us a bit more flexibility. But our focus was always on the maths and economics degree, but only 50% of that was mathematics. So that was rather constraining as to how much mathematics we could teach. We started off by teaching analysis, basic algebra, things. Well, there was a lot of mathematical methods at that time oriented towards the sort of maths that was needed in economics, because at that time we could not have made any progress without the support of the economics department, so it was politically important to keep them on side, as it were. But over the years we gradually increased the range of mathematics that we taught, and then fairly recently, sort of within the last 10 years, there was the degree in maths with economics introduced, which was 75% mathematics. So that enables us now to teach a much broader range of mathematical subjects.
Were you involved in any sort of academic boards or committees?
Well, my main role in the school level was, I think, 1993 to 96. I was what was called vice chairman of the appointments committee. The appointments committee was the committee of professors, and the chairman of it was the director. Its function at that time was all promotions and appointments. New appointments, except for professorial appointments, which were handled by the director in person. So lectureship appointments and promotions, which at that time lecturers promoted to senior lecturer, reader, professor and so forth, were done by that. I served on that committee as an ordinary member soon after I came, and I think it was 1993 when I was made the vice chairman. Now, at that time, the hierarchy in the school consisted of a director and one pro-director only, and below that level, the next level was myself, vice chairman of the appointments committee, and a vice chairman of the academic board. And so we served in roles which had some impact, and I used to attend, for example, the director's Monday morning strategy meetings, where these senior persons got together and tried to sort out any problems that could occur. And so at that period, I was quite involved in a number of things. I was told by my predecessor when I took over that, in fact, I could try to avoid getting too much involved in political activities, as you might call them, at the higher levels within the school, and I could focus on the main business of the job, which was actually doing the appointments and the promotions. I personally chaired most of the selection committees for lecturers in all subjects in the LSE, and at that time that was quite an important role, important anyway, but it was becoming more important because we were becoming more and more aware, as everybody was, of the legal requirements in making these appointments in a regular and decent fashion. There had been a long tradition going back of rather unsatisfactory procedures of making appointments to lectureships, people being appointed over a drink in the bar and this kind of thing. And that was going out. But I had to try and navigate the new ethos, as it were, there, without losing the fact that we were appointing academic staff and that we should not be hidebound by the rules. It was called personnel in those days, and the people in personnel, of course, had very rigid rules as to what they thought we should be doing. And we had to try and make clear that we were appointing academic staff potentially for a lifetime job, and therefore it was important to do that very carefully. The other change that took place while I was doing that job was that the promotions to readers and professors, the internal promotions, which had previously been University of London procedures, professors and readers were professors and readers in the University of London. So up to that time, the LSE had its own procedures for making these things, but they were only recommendations at that time. And then after the LSE had been through its committee and its they'd been validated, as it were, because there was a committee called the Standing Subcommittee of the Appointments Committee, and that was the committee which did a very thorough job in looking at all the promotion candidates. That was a small group of eight people, plus the director, the pro-director and myself. After that, the recommendations had to be endorsed by the entire appointments committee, that is, all the professors, and that led to some very interesting situations. But when that was done, it was still only a recommendation to the university, and we had to wait several months and do all the paperwork to get it through the university's procedures. But I think it was 1995 or 1996 that that was abolished. The university withdrew from that, and all the member institutions like the LSE were allowed to make their own appointments at professorial and reader level. So there was quite a lot of work in changing those procedures one year. In one year, I remember, we had to actually devise the new procedures and implement them all in the course of one academic year. And I was always rather pleased that that went tolerably well and there were no great difficulties. Because promotions has always been a very sensitive issue, and perhaps not so much nowadays when we have a different sort of setup. But there had been many long-standing difficulties, first of all with individuals who'd been disappointed, and secondly within departments where there wasn't always total agreement on the promotions and appointments that had been made. And these led to a lot of aggravation for my predecessors.
Did you find that working with the colleagues in your department an intellectually stimulating experience?
Yes, it was stimulating because there were a heterogeneous group of people, but initially there was no contact with people who were working in the same area as I was. That began to change as the appointments were made, and we gradually built up a group of people so that with colleagues and at that time research students were relatively few, but with that we were soon able to have a little group, and there was no seminar, no regular seminar in mathematics, for example, until I came. That was one of the first things that I tried to establish, and that gradually sort of built up a little nucleus of people who were interested in similar subjects, and so that tended to make the environment more intellectually stimulating. And of course there was the impetus that came from the things being done in other departments. One of the first things I did when I came was to write to about half a dozen departments who seemed that they might be vaguely interested in mathematics, and try and ask them what was going on and if there were people in their departments who had any specific interests and what kind of mathematics that was. That led to three or four quite interesting responses. The economists, of course, I discovered had quite a lot of quite technical mathematics, but in a rather hit and miss way, in that various bits of mathematics had become important in economics, and there were people in economics who knew those areas of mathematics extremely well. In finance and accounting, I discovered that there had been a breakthrough in financial mathematics, which till I came here I knew nothing of, the so-called Black-Scholes theory, option pricing and so forth, which latterly became a very important and well-known feature of financial mathematics. But that was unknown to me until I was in touch with the accounting, it was then called an accounting and finance department, and I was put in touch with the person there who was basically doing the mathematics of finance using this new Black-Scholes theory, stochastic calculus and so forth. So that was quite stimulating, and I did do a little bit of work in that area myself. There was a contact also with psychology, strangely enough, in that there was somebody there who was quite interested in learning theory and so forth, which had some relevance to mathematics, although nothing really came of that. I did have a research student, Martin Anthony, who is now head of the mathematics department, worked here on what we call statistical learning theory, which is quite technical mathematics, but that never really made a serious link with the psychologists, and the psychologists here being more, of course, social psychology rather than experimental or cognitive psychology.
How has the technological revolution, how has the technological change over the years affected the subject that you teach?
Well, when I came here, the LSE was very backward in its technology. There was a very strange structure which allowed a group of people, I forget exactly what they were called now, but there was a group of IT people who rather regarded themselves as experts, although in fact their expertise was very limited. And because most departments, of course, being social sciences, were very backward in their use of IT, the IT provision from the point of view of statistics and mathematics was very poor at that time. That gradually changed in that the statisticians, economists, and of course mathematicians, most of whom had far greater expertise in the technical side of these things than the people in the IT organisational administration or whatever it was, gradually began to make their voices heard. And so we did, I think it probably took about 10 years for the message to get through. And eventually, of course, IT was subsumed into the provision of the library, and where there were people who had much greater vision and so forth. But I can have tell many anecdotes about sort of how poor things were at that time. For example, when I came here, there was some software called Mathematica, which was becoming quite high, well used in mathematics, statistics and other departments. And so I inquired what the status of this was, and said I would like to have Mathematica, which was a package, to be installed on my machine. I did have a machine, a very antiquated machine, but I was told that Mathematica was being evaluated by some member of the IT administration or whatever it was. When I tried to find out who this person was, I discovered he had very little background in mathematics, and the idea that the professor of mathematics should actually be the one who was evaluating mathematical software seemed to be quite alien to the situation as it then obtained. That has gradually changed down the year, but it took a long, long time. When Professor Anthony Atkinson came to statistics, he came around the same time as I did, and he came from Imperial College, and he was appalled at the backward nature of the technological provision at that time.
So you mentioned that obviously the lack of technological innovation at LSE when you first arrived. What have been the other sort of looking across your whole entire time here at LSE, what have been the other sort of big challenges that you've had to face?
Well, I think the challenges now are the sort of short-term planning and these REFs and things like that. When I was doing the appointing of lecturers, let's call it the RAE, which I think is what it was before it was an REF, I was still able to take a long-term view of an appointment and to say, this person, I'm not just talking about mathematics, I'm talking about all subjects, this is a top-ranking person, has the right sort of background and so forth. Maybe a person might have only been 22. We did appoint one or two people as young as that. You know, this is the kind of person we want. They haven't had the opportunity to write all these so many papers according to the formula and so forth, but they are clearly the outstanding person, and we'll make that appointment. And the system that we had, a system of departmental and major reviews at that time, allowed that to happen and allowed us to give the person basically 5 years in order to develop. But what has changed because of the pressures is that I don't think anybody would now think of appointing a person who hadn't already got the required publications for the next RAE or REF or whatever it was. And so we are appointing people in their late 20s rather than their early 20s. So that's a great change. And I think that's, in a way, a slightly sad situation, because it means departments are more, in a way, homogeneous and settled. It's always good to have some younger people coming in. We can still do this occasionally, but departments like mathematics and so forth, we now get, for example, 100 applicants for any lectureship in mathematics from all over the world, and to get onto the long shortlist, they would all have to have their RAE publications, REF publications, all signed and settled. So I think that's changed a little bit the sort of ethos of the way the school is run. Departments have become more sort of coherent and so forth. Even departments like sociology. When I came, there was a sociology department, but I was surprised to find that its members occupied rooms in about 6 different buildings. They were about as far apart as could possibly be arranged, given the given the numbers of them, and the idea of nesting departments and getting people sort of rubbing shoulders. In mathematics, in most universities at that time, it had always been sort of mathematicians got together for coffee and talked about mathematics. They talked about other things as well, but they also, that was the sort of feeling. There wasn't a lot of that at the LSE at that time. I think the economists made a move towards that when they had their new research centre and so forth set up, so that people could rub shoulders, and that's more accepted. The other thing that's changed, I think, is the provision for lectures and so forth. The old lecture rooms were, as I said before, very cramped, small places. Even the larger ones, I was in the old theatre to teach a class at one time, and we were still struggling very much with the technology at that time. The LSE always had sort of grand ideas, and in fact they introduced visualizers quite early on, but the technology of the visualizers was very poor, and it was much more in that the students couldn't actually see the image that was being projected very clearly. They were nothing like as good as they are at the moment. There were no computers, and most of us by that time for the larger classes would be using the overhead projector, and the overhead projector was in fact vastly superior to the technology that was actually provided in the that old theatre, and the new theatre as well. The new theatre had not been refurbished at that time. That's the new theatre, which is now being demolished as part of the that building. So that changed, I think. Think of any other changes. I can't really sort of affecting our sort of daily operations. There is more sort of a focused feeling of what a department ought to be doing, a whole range of activities. Although at the LSE it is still slightly restricted, departments don't have much to do with admitting students at the LSE, whereas in many universities, the sort of August operation of admissions and clearing and so forth is a major thing in the work of the department. We still maintain in mathematics, this was a bit of a struggle at first, we maintain the LSE always had the personal tutor system, but it didn't operate very effectively in many departments, because students were not in the habit, basically, of going to see their personal tutor regularly. We tried to introduce that and make that a regular thing in mathematics and other departments as well, and that I think now works fairly well, so that students do have a contact with a personal tutor, an academic. However, they tend to look now. Originally, when I came, I think they had, if they didn't have contact with their personal tutor, then they had very little contact with the institution as a whole. But of course, now we have student services and counsellors and so forth. There is that alternative, and some students tend to sort of look that way rather than to their academic personal tutor for their help and advice.
Were you involved in any recreational activities on campus?
I can't. I never played for the football team. I can't really think of any serious. No, and I never sang in the choir or played in the orchestra. So, yeah. I still live in the. All my time at the LSE, I lived in Outer London, just outside the M25. So my routine, when I was heavily involved, would be travelling to the LSE and doing basically a 9-to-5 stint, probably only 4 days a week if I could manage it. But for some times when I was doing the job I was telling you about, I would be 5 days a week commuting. And that always sort of constrained me as far as sort of staying around in the evenings and going to the bar and all this kind of thing. When I was in the hierarchy, I had to attend a number of sort of dinners for honorary fellows and special visitors and things like that. But that wasn't a sort of LSE environment. That was sort of, putting on a good face for the important visitors and so forth. So I did my bit of that, but nothing of the sort of what you're talking about, the social activities, yes.
Do you have a favourite place on campus that you'd like to liked over the years?
Not really, I think. I mean, there were times. We used at one time to be accommodated quite close to what used to be called the Brunch Bowl, which was a, I forget what it's called now, but it's on the fourth floor of the main building. That was quite often a place where we would meet. And the staff would quite often go to the senior dining room. That would be a bit of sociology at lunchtime, as it were, there's of course a common room next to the senior dining room, which I did sort of spend a little time in, but I was never one of the sort of regulars sunk in an armchair there. I used to use the library quite a lot because I had other interests of hobby type, actually, which I found the library was quite good at providing information for. The library is not particularly strong for mathematics, and that matters less and less nowadays because so much information is available on the websites and so forth electronically, so the things that we tell the students to look at, they don't need necessarily to have hard copies of books for that. I like libraries, and I used to spend quite a bit of time in the library, probably more time before it was rebuilt, because there used to be a very interesting basement of the old library, where you could root around and find all kinds of stuff which had basically been buried there. Otherwise, there wasn't a great deal. I mean, there wasn't a great deal of sort of social gathering places in the LSE at that time. We didn't have a departmental coffee room or anything. Now, in where we are now, and we've been in this building for, I think, at least 10 years, more like 15 years. I think it was around 2000 we came over here. There is a sort of social space, but there was really nothing of that in the way that the, as I was mentioning to you about, sociology department being scattered to the four winds and so forth. Departments didn't really have their social spaces for communicating at that time.
What do you think the future of LSE will be?
Well, I think it's in the balance in a way. It aspires to be a leading university on the world stage. And it aspires also to attract a reasonable number of the best students from the UK. We have the EU students and the overseas students as well. And the pressures have always been to recruit more of the students who can be asked to pay higher fees. And there is a danger in that, and always has been, in that that can determine the shape of the institution, because if government changes the mechanism, as it changed the mechanism to have the student loans and the 9,000 a year, we are told that's going to be changed again. If it turns out that that disadvantages the recruitment of home and EU students, for example, then that, through sheer economics, tends to change the shape of the LSE. The LSE can always recruit large numbers of students from overseas and demand high fees. If the economic realities continue to force it to do that, then it becomes a different kind of institution. There are a number of signs, in my view, which would tend to make it more and more of what you might call a correspondence college. That is, students spending less and less time actually here, going to lectures, talking to their lecturers, talking with each other, and more time online, possibly in remote places. We've always had a few students who've tried to do that anyway, and one of the things that concerned me for a number of years when I was head of department and latterly was students who seemed to just disappear, and very difficult to trace where they were. And some of them would then say, well, I've been doing all the work online and things like that, and of course that's not exactly what a university education ought to be. So there is a danger that the LSE might turn into a sort of centre for students all over the world to learn in that mode, which is different from the traditional mode of learning with direct personal contact with a teacher, a lecturer, and so forth. I think there are still sufficiently many influential people around to try to prevent that happening, but I'm not sufficiently involved at the higher levels now to know what the ethos is. Certainly, until about 5 or 6 years ago, I used to know most of the people who were basically running things, and I was quite confident that they would sort of agree with the point of view that I was talking about. But I'm not entirely sure where we're going now.
So you have actually answered all the questions that I had. But thinking back on everything that we've talked about, is there anything you'd like to say or you'd like to tell me about that you feel that we haven't covered or I haven't asked you about?
No, I think at the level of my talking off the top of my head, as it were, that's quite adequate. I don't really want to sort of go into too much anecdotal evidence.
Okay, so you have actually been talking.